This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, where we go behind the headlines and explore what's driving the press. I'm Shazana Mukhtar. It was only 20 months ago that Malaysians pulled off the first ever transition of government in our country's young history. But the view of that historic event looks a little different from the vantage point that we're now at, with little distance and some time. So as we, and by we I mean we as a nation, figure out where we want to steer the country moving forward, it's worth reflecting on the dynamics, circumstances, and issues that actually culminated in the outcome of GE14. And that's what a new compilation of essays, that's what it brings to the table. And it's titled Rebirth, Reformasi, Resistance, and Hope in New Malaysia. So today on the show, I'm joined by the editor of the book, Malaysian journalist Kian Wong, as well as Tricia Yeo, a fellow at the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, Ideas, and Beth Yap, a writer, and both contributed to the anthology. So welcome to the show, everyone.
Thank you.
I wanted to start the discussion with a look at the book itself. So I have a copy here in front of me. And I want you, Kian, to tell us about the cover, which is really arresting. Maybe you could sort of describe it for our listeners and tell us why you chose this image to represent the book.
Partly because I think when we were looking around for a nice graphic, I was really quite keen on not going the usual route, to me, a bit lazy, of doing photographic covers. And I really wanted to celebrate, I think, some amazing contemporary art that, you know, happens in Malaysia, especially from women artists, especially from artists from East Malaysia. So Xia Yi Ying's painting, an artwork, which was sold in 2014, part of a series called Tolerance. One of the three panels is the cover of the book. And Yi Ying was great, very enthusiastic when I told her of this project, and she was very keen to be part of it, and here we are.
All right. So in that case, what's the idea behind Rebirth?
It's really, for me, an occasion, I think, for Malaysians here and abroad to take seriously if we want to look at May 2018 as a historic moment in our fairly young nation's history. And if we are, then I think it's really important we should document it, and document it hopefully on fact-based, evidence-based discussions of what happened and the policy debates that occurred and are still occurring and what the near future might bring, without indulging, I think, in too much armchair punditry and speculation, which unfortunately seems to be quite prevalent, at least among urban Malaysians today.
And what was your, I suppose, process of curating these essays? How did you decide which pieces that you wanted to include or commission?
Well, the basis of it really was to do with a special series that I was editing for the Australian National University's Southeast Asia site, New Mandala, which I was editing before, after, and actually during GE14. That's the bulk of the essays. There, about a fifth of it is new work, new essays, one of which closes the book by Beth, which is a really nice excursion, hopefully, to what the new future might bring. It also includes policy pieces which are still vexed today, like Tricia's about federalism. So the motivation really, yeah, still comes down to, I think, celebrating fact-based, evidence-based discussions and reportage.
There was something about the book. You divided it into four different sections. So you've got Twilight, Dawn, High Noon, and Chapter 4, which is labeled as Four More Years, so it's not a time of day. Why is the book structured in this way?
I think because it's really just, you know, maybe a basic dramatic device to really look, to take our history seriously. I think that seems quite important. It's quite bizarre to me that I think Malaysians are very upset about a whole bunch of things, get very worked up about a bunch of things. But in some ways, they don't take themselves as a nation seriously. And I think that's something we need to do. And I mean, I'm only half joking sometimes when I explain to people about the book that one reason why we try and take East Malaysia seriously and have some discussions in there and have an East Malaysian, you know, help present our book in the cover is because I really partly think seriously that East Malaysia will save Malaysia as a nation, because the original idea of a coherent nation might still reside there.
We're going to get more into East Malaysia and how that fits in, I suppose, new Malaysia today. But one more question just on the arrangement. I noticed that the essays weren't arranged in any particular chronological order either. I guess, was there a reason behind that, or was just that how things came about?
Just the way I was hoping that people might read it from beginning to end and how it might flow, that's all. Some of it has to do, with themes. I'd be happy to hear from readers who encounter it, the typos aside, you know, what else, you know, how they might take to it and whether it was an accurate reflection of what actually happened and what is to come.
I think that's what I found particularly fascinating about the book, the fact that you're reading something with the benefit of hindsight. We know what happens next, and it's really interesting to read these names of people who were standing for election then and to know where they are today. I thought that was it's a bit of a treat, I suppose, to read it, kind of having that fortune teller notion of moving forward. I wanted to then compare that then and now sentiment. I mean, the euphoria, I think we can all say it has definitely died down. And what would you say is the prevailing sentiment at the moment? And does this change the way in which we view the events of GE14? Maybe you could start with Beth.
So I have a kind of expatriate's view, and I missed 2018, the elections. So for me, there was a sense of disbelief at what happened because I wasn't here on the ground seeing it. But I came back Chinese New Year last year, and really there still was, besides my jadedness, sort of thinking we're having a replay of everything that happened 20 years before with the same old players in place, I was really surprised. You know, going down to the ground. And I'd spent since 2004 tracking a number of women politicians and, you know, writing about elections as they came up. You know, people were still hopeful, slightly jaded, but, you know, kind of hopeful and sort of saying, you know, people, so I caught up with people like Elizabeth Wong, you know, who sort of said, well, we just killed a huge giant, but it's not dead. The carcass is still there. And she, you know, we were both Buffy and the Vampire Slayer fans. And she was saying, well, you know, you've got to stake them more than once. So there was a sense, you know, and she kept, you know, and I kept saying, well, you've got an authoritarian ex-prime minister and current prime minister who is famous for being authoritarian. But she was still, you know, saying, well, you know, he's spoken up for human rights. So far, so good. For me, as an outsider, I saw the flip, came here, saw people who were, you know, I caught up with other politicians who were doing small things, taking small steps and sort of saying we can't actually achieve very much in 1 year compared to 65 years.
That's right. It has been just a year. What about yourself, Tricia? Do you think that people are looking at GE14 in a different way now?
Well, I think when it first happened, I mean, I have a few thoughts on that. I think the first thing is that the government, you know, went into action very swiftly. And in a way, I think the nation did not have enough time to pause and to reflect on this big momentous occasion and what actually had taken place. So I think in a way, you know, this volume, as well as some of the other volumes that are emerging out of the election, I think that does serve its purpose in helping us to reflect on that moment. Because if you remember, I mean, they were so eager to, you know, set up committees and set up all kinds of panels. And I think the expectations were very high as well. So even to not just pause and reflect, but even to pause and celebrate that moment, I think that didn't happen. So in a way, it's a little bit sad, I suppose, that such a momentous thing happened and there was no, you know, real moment for the whole nation to collectively come together on that note. But then, of course, on hindsight today, you know, when I say the word celebrate, I think that is also said with some level of skepticism and cynicism, I suppose, because, you know, if you look at the opinion poll ratings today, unfortunately, the government has not been able to maintain its popularity amongst people. And if you reflect upon, you know, the 1.5 years that has passed since then, I would argue that the first 6 months, those 6 months were the triumphant months. A lot of reforms, policy-wise at least, were being at least announced and committed to. And then at the end of that six-month period, right in the December, I think, of 2018, you saw a whole bunch of issues coming to pass. And these issues have escalated till today. And what those issues are essentially... we can talk about them, but I think, you know, listeners will remember your anti-ICERT rally, your anti-Rome statute rally, and culminating through many, many events over the last year, including what's happening with the school system, and I think exacerbating these already pre-existing tensions within the ethno-religious spectrum, which I think... unfortunately, the new opposition alliance has done very well in taking advantage of. So that's where we are today.
I think that's a really striking point. The fact that we were united for a little while in GE14, and then less than 2 years after, we're kind of back into a divisive mode. Do you think that Malaysians are on the same page in terms of their dissatisfaction towards Pakatan Harapan? I mean, how would the government even try to address all the different grievances towards them? It just seems that nobody's happy with them in a way.
Just a short note on that. I think it's because when you have a coalition that is trying to serve the sometimes competing interests of the dichotomous nature of our society, that's when you end up not necessarily satisfying either one. So on the one hand, say the more progressive liberal circles would not be happy about the progress and speed of which some of the reforms are taking place. Yes, while there are some reforms being announced, you know, and many of them are taking place in Parliament, say the drafting of the IPCMC bill, the political financing reform bill, the Freedom of Information bill. And these are quite revolutionary. These are the things that civil society has long called for the past decade. But then the speed at which it's going is probably too slow for the liking of these progressive circles. And at the same time, on the other end of the spectrum, you have the more conservative communities that are probably not staking so much of their claims on these reforms. It's not important to them. And what's more important to them is to see that the government is still, you know, looking out for their interests, bearing in mind that many of these, you know, Bumiputra type companies or government institutions are still very much there. I mean, nothing has been abolished, nothing has been rolled back in that sense. But I think the fear and the kind of sentiments that unfortunately were played into during the campaigning of the election and the consequent by-elections, that has continued to sow the seeds of this distrust. Mm.
Kian, you were mentioning about engagement on policy issues, and you were hoping that this book will be able to sort of crystallize some of those policy discussions. I guess post-GE14, do you think Malaysians are more engaged in policy issues, or is it back to the way it was before and leading more by sentiment than...
I think the good thing that Tricia was raising about this dichotomous nature of the debate and the discussion in the community really also speaks to my experience of covering, I guess, several general elections over the last 25 years in Malaysia, where traveling the country again this time for GE14, it struck me that actually there are many different Malaysias. And one thing that's very important and very difficult to do in some ways is do good government that is coherent and cohesive, and that we really do need reinforcement until you're so bored of it, of a national narrative. And that has been missing. And in some ways, you could say previous recent governments haven't been able to do that, even though they tried with things like One Malaysia, because the government needs to have some political capital and credibility to execute it, and they never did. And one thing that this government has had is great goodwill, and in a way, they have very much been, you know, the expression of an extraordinary thing that ordinary Malaysians did one day in 2018. And I think something like that needs to be translated and told in a storyline. And I tried to sort of partly talk about that in the introduction to the book. And I think just for myself, you know, writing about what I thought was a revealing post-GE14 trip across Australia by Lim Kit Siang and Tian Chua, that little essay, and I thought for me made was very revealing about how hopefully we dream the same dreams of Malaysia, but in fact everyone has slightly different versions of it, you know. And I think in some ways we need to have that conversation.
I'm speaking to editor and journalist Kian Wong, as well as Tricia Yeo, a fellow at Ideas, and writer Beth Yap. We'll be back with more conversation after these messages. Stay with us, BFM 89.9. Hello, this is Pressing Matters on the Morning Run. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and I'm joined by Kian Wong, the editor of Rebirth, a compilation of essays on GE14 and its aftermath, as well as Tricia Yeo, a fellow at the think tank Ideas, and writer Beth Yap, both who contributed to the book. I'm going to move on to another part of the book, and specifically your contribution, Tricia, which was looking at federal-state relations. So I thought it was really fascinating because it showed a sort of snapshot about how relations between opposition-held states like Penang and Selangor with the federal government, and how that's evolved since they changed hands several GEs ago. So I guess looking at it today, how have state governments like Penang and Selangor fared now that they're actually in the government and they're no longer in the opposition side?
Okay. So actually, well, my first thought on the federal-state relationship post-GE, if we can broaden out a little bit, is that I think the problems that opposition-led states, under the Barisan federal government faced are still prevalent today when those are the other states that led by the opposition, right? So now you've got Warisan in Sabah. Okay, not necessarily opposition. They are a supportive party of Pakatan Harapan. And then you've got UMNO in Perlis and Pahang, and PAS in Kelantan and Terengganu. So you have actually quite an interesting plethora of different relationships between the federal and the state governments. And some of the problems that are emerging today from the opposition-led states are similar problems to what the Pakatan-led states faced in the past, which is all to say that it is evidently an institutional problem that has not yet been resolved, which I don't think the current federal government recognizes as a problem. And I don't see any reforms on the table. So that out of the way, I will proceed to tell you what I think some of those are. So one thing that I think the opposition-led states in the past faced was the sort of vague relationship when it came to certain constitutional matters. And these would be constitutional matters that are supposedly shared between federal and state. So this would be water services. I might bore you with very technical things, but I mean that when it's vague as to which federal or state needs to make a decision on the matter, most of the time it will emerge that the federal government makes that decision, and then the opposition-led state does not really have much say in the matter. So I think that that this will continue. An example of that is when we had parallel, what we call Jawatan Kuasa, Keselamatan Kampung, which is village committees that were running in parallel. One stream was controlled by the state government and the other stream was controlled by the federal government. And then the federal government then thought that it was necessary to have them there because then they could have an alternative parallel channel of funding and activities being implemented. So the same thing is happening in these other now opposition-led states. And I believe it is, you know, wastage of resources. It also means that the state government of the day is not given the respect that it should be in terms of funds and, you know, reporting of activity lines and so on. Another big problem is that states actually don't have enough financial autonomy. And because of that, they resort to certain measures which may actually be detrimental on, say, the environment. Because one of the main sources of revenues for the state comes from natural resources. And this is why you see in Kelantan, for instance, there has been a lot of debate about, you know, where do they get the money from? The federal government has given them some of the royalties. But today you see in the news that there's questions as to whether they've used that money for the right purposes or buying luxury cars. Or in the past, having to, you know, resort to deforestation because it is a natural resource and the money, some of that goes to the state government. So one of the things that I put forward in a policy paper that I wrote for Ideas last year was that there needs to be a revision or at least a whole rethink and probably some analysis as to whether the federal government can really look at how the resources are distributed or whether state governments themselves can generate some revenues. Because if they continue to depend on the natural resources available to them, whether it's, you know, from land or forest, we know that that's not going to be sustainable.
You're right. I think that's something that people really miss out on, the fact that state governments are constrained in where they can get their funding from. It's very easy to demonize them for destroying the environment when you don't understand that sometimes maybe that's the only option that they have when they're being limited by the federal government. It's interesting that you say that the federal government doesn't really realize that this federal-state relation is a problem for them.
I think they realize that the importance primarily in Sabah and Sarawak, because that's where, you know, it has potential political and electoral implications. But for the states in the peninsula, I think it's sort of, you know, a very, you know, secondary, tertiary issue to address. But when it comes to issues of Sabah and Sarawak, then yes, I think they do realise the importance. And seeing as the next big election that's coming up will be the Sarawak state elections in 2 years' time.
I think that's... Yeah,
1 year.
In 1 year, in 2021.
That's right. Within next year.
I think Sabah and Sarawak are really interesting simply because after GE14, their sort of political alliances really completely changed. It's like a whole new political world there in East Malaysia. So from your vantage points as observers, I guess, what's most striking to you and what are you going to be looking out for in the next few years as elections come up, both state and general?
Well, I think the Sabah-Sarawak situation is an indicator of how fluid general Malaysian politics actually is trending towards and will have to be, where it will be issues of many so-called micro-alliances and fluid alliances that could change, that are in many ways a return to that either transactional type of politics that has been prevalent, subsuming the type of ideology that's driven, say, UMNO previously. I think it's very indicative that for the near future, you know, Pakatan itself, always being described as some sort of fragile coalition, needs to therefore, I think, you know, have a greater sense of purpose to tell its story to itself, to make its own reality in some ways. And I think that is why we keep, you know, I keep going back to, I guess, talking about this idea of a national narrative that can be inclusive or exclusive, depending on who is crafting it.
And also one that, you know, doesn't consider Sabah and Sarawak as a given.
Yeah.
You know, as the kind of the safety vote. And I think, you know, I mean, for me, I think a lot of the work, you know, huge amount of policy work, But part of the big work also, and you know I'm probably saying this because I'm a storyteller, is about reframing the narrative, you know. So in terms of, you know, we have this fluidity, and I wonder if, you know, I often think, you know, Malaysians are so terrified of change, you know, after spending so long asking for change. And when it comes, it doesn't come fast enough, or it comes too soon, or, you know, it's too scary. And I wonder if there's a way of, you know, changing the language in which we talk about things, you know, like race relations or, you know, or Sabah and Sarawak. You know, and I think there's quite a lot of work in terms of, you know, kind of telling alternative views of history, you know, kind of rehabilitating, you know, recouping in a sense our hidden histories that, you know, were suppressed for such a long time. I've been doing a project with Malaysia Design Archive, you know, who sort of see themselves as archiving material that, you know, was not considered, you know, worthy of being recorded. You know, I think the kind of incredible thing with Malaysia Design Archive, we, you know, we invited Indigenous storytellers to come over. And for many of the people in the room, you know, it was the first time that they actually directly engaged. You know, so I think there is a kind of invisible wall that we sort of, you know, we have the names of things, but we don't actually have the kind of that the interrogation that goes in with thinking about what is this narrative doing? How do we speak about these things in a way that doesn't set off, you know, the sentiment and lead, you know, so that the sentiment is the thing that frames how we speak about things.
I think the next election will be very interesting because it will be the first time that you see the UMNO PAS alliance in action. I mean, if it can last that long. And the other thing I would be interested in, you know, seeing if it happens, I don't think it will, but I'm interested to see whether there can also be, you know, a decentralization of political coalitions. So, you know, do the parties all need to adhere to the one big coalition at every state, or can there be, you know, multiple relationships, multiple coalitions being formed at the state level? Because again, to bring up Sabah and Sarawak, it's very interesting because the parties in Sarawak, I know this because I've done some research on it, have, you know, very close to come to breaking point with the positions taken at the national level. I won't say which party it is, but all I'm saying is that sometimes the issues differ. Sometimes what you need to champion at the federal level or at different states, say what you need to champion in, say, Selangor or Kelantan or Perak, Johor, might be different from what you can champion in Sabah and Sarawak. And maybe the local politicians need that space. So I would love to see that happening. I don't think it will because, you know, Malaysia is so centralized, whether you talk about government or in politics or in many other ways. Yeah, but those are the two things I'd like to look out for.
I think the closing chapters of the book, there are two that are a pair by Greg Lopez and James Chin that talk about whether, and arguing in fact in some ways that there was no regime change, but that also Sarawak and Sabah have this fluidity which shows potential for change. It, you know, talks to the issues you've just raised, Tricia, which, you know, I think entirely relevant for the rest or for Semenanjung as well. And I think that's something that, yeah, I mean, you know, if Malaysians really believe in this nation that includes all of the above, then I think we really need to enlarge our own imaginations of where we should go.
I want to end the discussion on this one last question. What do you think of this term Malaysia Baru that came out after GE14? I mean, do you think new Malaysia still has meaning 20 months on?
Well, I would say yes, there is. And it matters a lot, especially outside of Malaysia. And that's partly why I used the book. The title for the book. There is actually a lot of discussion in the region, as well as even I know policy friends as far away as in Washington, who really see the Malaysian story since 2018 as a good news story for a sort of, you know, liberal rules-based order of how democracy can work. And that's, you know, I think something that Malaysians should be proud of and should work towards.
I think depending on who you talk to, of course, they'll say different things. And there is a large growing group of people who will say that there's no change. You know, the same players are in power as they were, you know, you know, 30, 40 years ago. But from my perspective, I think there is validity to say that there was and that there is a Malaysia Baru. I mean, I think, you know, coming from the policy perspective, definitely there have been many changes. You know, the National Anti-Corruption Plan that was launched actually is really reflective of many of the desires of think tank work that has been put in over the years, also from civil society. So I think on that perspective, people shouldn't forget that there are efforts to get the country back on track. But at the same time, I think it is slowed down tremendously by other factors. And those are the factors that I would say, you know, weigh down the ability of this Malaysia Baru ship to move forward quickly enough.
I think the kind of most powerful effect of the, you know, change of government and the kind of creation of Malaysia Baru was that moment, you know, that and people after many, many years of struggling against it, against the old regime, suddenly there was regime change. And I think that's huge in terms of the kind of the imaginary of how do we make this country. You know, what kind of effect do I have as a, you know, a person on the street, going out into the street, going to those protests? And, you know, and I think, you know, for me, that is the thing that is new. But, yeah, I remember in my piece in the book, I tracked down Nuruliza, who I, you know, have tracked over the last few elections, and she was rather offended when I asked her about what she thought about Malaysia Baru. And she said, which struck me at the time, she said, you know, there is no Malaysia Baru, there's just Malaysia. And Malaysia is something that changes. You know, and I think that's also, you know, one of the things that we find very hard to, you know, in the same way that we thought about Malaysia Lama was that it was something that would never change. And I think that's, for me, that's the carry away, that it is, you know, Malaysia is a country that many people have affected, contributed to, and will continue to do so.
I just have one last thought about this concept of Malaysia Baru. That might be exciting for some of us who are pro-reform, but I'm not sure that a large segment of our society actually voted for change in that sense. And I mean, I guess it goes back to these multiple Malaysias thing that we've been talking about throughout the whole interview, in that a lot of people actually like the status quo. And, you know, maybe when they think about change or Baru, maybe they were comfortable before. And, you know, I suppose here I'm alluding to the communities who were happy with the economic arrangements specific to quotas and so on and so forth. So I think there is also a danger of shaking that, you know, segment of the community.
It's so subjective, yeah. What does Baru mean? What does Lama mean? And this is a conversation that's going to continue for a while still. Thank you so much, Tricia, Kian, Beth.
Thank you, Shazana.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Kian, where can we find the book?
It's published by Gerak Budaya, so at their bookshop in Petaling Jaya, but also, I understand, throughout their bookshop network across the country. It's also going to be launched in Canberra, Sydney and Melbourne in the first quarter of this year.
All right. I've been speaking to editor and journalist Kian Wong, as well as Tricia Yeo, a fellow at the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, and Beth Yap, a writer. I'm Shazana Mukhtar, and this has been Pressing Matters, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.